podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. The England men's side are back playing Red Bull cricket and the Women's World Cup is just hours away from getting underway. I'm Yaz Rana and today I'm joined by the Editor-in-Chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker, the Magazine Editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, and a very special guest today, West Indies T20 World Cup winner and one of the most popular new voices on the commentary scene, Carlos Brathwaite. Thanks for joining the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We will also be playing an interview we did earlier with Shield Berry, the former Wisden editor and very famous cricket journalist whose claim to fame is watching more England tests live than any man living or dead. But first, let's head to Mark Butcher, who I spoke to earlier today about the West Indies England series and what it takes to win away in the West Indies. England very rarely win in West Indies. Butch, I think you were part of the only team to win out there in the last 50 years. England have just lost the Ashes 4-0. What kind of chance do you give England going into this series?
Well, I mean, every team since the 2004 side to go down there has gone down there as favourites. And for one reason or another, has come unstuck, whether that be spectacular batting collapses in the first Test match followed by timid declarations or just poor cricket, I suppose. Roston Chase having the match of his life, etc., etc. The reasons are myriad. But mainly, I think, the issue has been, and you could say this for all England tours of late anyway, is that they haven't managed to put enough runs on the board first time round. And the bowling attacks selected at times, haven't had the right ingredients to be able to unlock a batting lineup that is desperate to kind of hang in there and do the hard yards that England's batting lineups haven't been willing to do. Let's look at the 2004 bowling attack, for example, that went on to become the sort of the legendary four horsemen of the apocalypse in 2005. So you've got Hoggard with the new ball, Hoggard Harmison, Hoggard pitch up swing, Harmison swing pace bounce, then old ball Flintoff and Jones. Low skinny trajectory reverse swing from Jones, high pace and just relentless accuracy and height and hitting the pitch from Flintoff. And in that four, you had all of the ingredients to be able to take advantage of what are the usual characteristics of West Indies pitches. A little bit up and down, not a massive amount of lateral movement through the air unless the ball is brand spanking new. So you need people that can hit the pitch, hit the seam, and make the ball behave off the surface. Add that a spin bowler in Ashley Giles who is able to bowl long, long spells, give the fast bowlers a rest and go at two and over. And you've got the perfect ingredients really as a bowling attack. And as I've said, when you look at the batting, pitches can be very flat there. I mean, the old Antigua Recreation Ground, of course, where Lara got the 400 and breaking his own 370-odd. That no longer exists. So the pitches out there generally tend to be quite hard work in terms of batting. So you've got to dig your runs out. Mm. There aren't many passages of play where the ball is flying to all parts and, everyone's enjoying themselves. It can be quite grim. Wear a few and just churn out as many as you can possibly gather in order to get your noses in front of the matches.
You mentioned the pitches there briefly. Looking at the bowlers England have taken to the Caribbean, which do you think will suit conditions more than normal?
Mark Wood's going to be so, so important because he is so different from everybody else in terms of speed. However, you wouldn't say that he's, like a guy that's going to hit a relentless length and really exploit any sort of up and down movement. But he is definitely England's ace in the pack. Now, it's going to be incumbent upon the likes of Robinson, Wokes. Wokes is going to have to be the guy that makes breakthroughs with the new ball when and if it swings in the early part of things. He's very much the leader of the pack in terms of experience. But in terms of his style of bowling, he's perhaps not the leader of the pack for England. So Robinson, tall, hit the pitch, be accurate. Overton perhaps comes into the reckoning a little bit for England because of that fact. And Leach is going to be mighty important. I think, you know, the Grenada, I don't know enough about in terms of the playing surface. The new ground at Antigua, the spin bowlers certainly enjoy themselves there as well. So, you know, the spin is going to have to play a part, and Jack Leach is going to have to really step up and prove that he deserves not only the backing of his captain, which we've discussed many times. Does he have it? I don't know. But he's going to have it on this trip. And the seamers are going to have to work very, very hard to be able to give Mark Wood the opportunity to strike. And that means being unbelievably accurate, you know, keeping the run rates low so that when Mark Wood does get the chance to bowl, he's not doing it. You know, he's not doing it as a sort of as a donkey style bowler. He's doing it as a strike bowler, which is, you know, he's the only one that England have.
We're talking 2 days into the 4-day warm-up game. It's gone pretty well for England so far. Five of the top six past 50. Johnny Bairstow scored 100. I guess the only selection decision there was picking Dan Lawrence over Ollie Pope. Obviously, Pope had a really difficult Ashes. I'm actually quite surprised he's not in the team, because I was slightly surprised he got picked in the squad, but I thought if he's picked in the squad, he's going to play. Because when you've had a really hard run, is drink ferrying the best way to get you back into form? Would he not have been better coming back to Surrey and spending some time in the Nets with the coaches he's had since he was a kid?
I think so. I mean, you know, I was surprised that they took him on the trip. I think he needs time away from that environment. And, you know, he's already, I mean, if it was a computer game, he's already solved county cricket, right, in terms of his output. But it's more a case of being out of the spotlight, given the opportunity to go and work very, very hard at sorting out what type of player he wants to be and how he wants to go about turning his undoubted talent into run making potential, the only currency that matters at Test match level. And so, yeah, taking him on the trip and then not playing him, I'm not sure I get. Maybe there's some grand plan that I'm missing. But I tend to agree with you. You know, Lawrence has benefited massively from not being part of the debacle, really, in Australia. He's a very, very confident lad. He's not exactly the antidote to England's sort of quirkinesses in the top order. However, what he does have is a sort of a real street fighter's ability to make runs and perhaps to put a little bit of sting back on to the opposition given the opportunity. So I'd be very, very interested to see how that works out.
Mm. I guess another thing on Pope travelling and not playing is that a lot of people in the media, perhaps because they just want to see new names out there, kind of say, well, if you're not going to play the spare batter, you might as well bring someone who's not played before for experience. What do you see merit in that argument? Like, is that actually valuable, bringing someone who's not played Test cricket before? Like, is that an experience that puts them in better stead when they might potentially make their Test debut down the line?
Well, I'd flip that around and say, look, if taking another sort of low or middle to lower middle order batter on this trip, when you've got literally no cover for numbers 1, 2, and 3, is just mad. Mm. You know, are you telling me that if a finger gets broken, which can happen, which is likely in the West Indies, you know, to one of Lees or Crawley, or God forbid Joe Root, that Ollie Pope as the spare batter is going to bat 1, 2, or 3? Given everything that he suffered further on down the order, I think that's mad. So that's another area where I would say, look, I don't think that's been a particularly smart piece of selection. You know, if you wanted to take somebody for that sort of experience, at least, you know, I don't know about that argument. I don't know whether or not being in the environment, you know, carrying drinks, etc., then helps you out further down the line. I never did it. It was, you know, there you go, you're in, and all the very best. So I don't know. I don't know about that. But what I do know is if you're selecting a 15 or a 16, I don't know how many they take.
I think 16.
Which is a little bit more normal. That you would take, you'd want to take cover, wouldn't you? You take cover for fast bowlers, you take cover for top order batters, you take cover for middle order batters, you take cover for spin. And England have got no cover for the top order.
I think Andrew Strauss said when the squad was announced that Dan Lawrence could be an option to open. Dan Lawrence hasn't opened the batting since he was 18 in 2015.
No, it's just a bad call. It, I mean, you know, dress it up any way you want. Fingers crossed that it doesn't get exposed, but it's a bad call.
And finally, obviously, English Test cricket is a low ebb at the moment. It's been a pretty bleak last 11 months or so. What was on your kind of your England wish list for the series? What would you like to see happen by the end of it?
Look, I think win, lose or draw the series. I mean, obviously, I want England to win the series, right? Be amazing. I'm going to be out there. You know, there's no party like a winning party in the West Indies. I can guarantee you of that. I think one of the most dispiriting things about the last, particularly the Australian tour, but at various and multitudinous occasions over the last 2 or 3 years, has been just how easy England are to beat at times.
Mm.
You can, you know, everyone can think of examples where they haven't lied down and where there has been something amazing happening. You know, Ben Stokes, for example. However, you know, more often than not, England find themselves a little bit behind or a little bit up against it in a match, and the whole thing is over in a blink of an eye. You know, there's just no, you know, the NASA's great thing back in the late 90s when it took over was, okay, we're definitely not the worst side in the world, even though the stats said we were. We're definitely not the best side in the world, but goodness gracious, we're going to make ourselves a lot more difficult to beat these days. And it's something that's come out of the South Africa camp after their victory just recently in New Zealand, about having that bloody-mindedness and that grit and that fight and determination not to give victories away. And I think England have given victories away so, so easily in the recent past that is the thing that I would like to see stop. Mm. And if you do that, you find yourselves in positions to win matches against the head a little bit, particularly away from home. And so the resilience is absolutely the thing that I want to see, particularly from the batting lineup.
Nice one. Well, safe travels and see you there in a couple of weeks.
Can't wait.
Carlos, between us, we've spent a lot of time previewing the series from an English perspective over the last few weeks. It'd be really good to get a sense of where West Indies are at the moment. They've had some positive results in the last year or so, winning in Bangladesh, that one wicket win against Pakistan, a few defeats thrown there as well. And I asked partially because, barring a handful of established stars, it's a squad with a lot of names that won't be hugely familiar to England fans.
Yeah, I think the most important thing for, I think, West Indies as a culture, as a team, regardless of format, is batting. And how can you put together consistent batting performances as a unit? Even when you look back at the Bangladesh performance, there were a couple of standout performers, Kyle Mears and Kumar Bonner, and they would have carried the batting a bit. And we've found in the past that there was always that one person, that one partnership that could always stand out. You think of Jason Holder's 100 in Antigua versus England, Jermaine Blackwood 100 in Antigua versus England in 2015 as well. But what West Indies have been searching for is a complete batting performance. And the closest we've probably gotten to that in a long while pre-Bangladesh was ironically against England. Jason Holder getting a double, Shane Dowrich getting 100 and a comprehensive win at Kensington Oval. So they'd be on the hunt for another complete batting performance. And I think there are a lot of places up for grabs in the middle order and a few guys who'd want to stake the claim coming back into the team.
Mm. I mean, we generally do get to see the best of West Indies against England. Their record against England is so good recently.
Yeah, what is that about then, Carlos? How come whenever England go out to the West Indies, firstly, we always go out there quite smugly and think, well, we're probably going to get a result. We never do, to begin with.
That might be part of it right there, the smugness.
But why is it that, you know, West Indian cricketers seem to raise their game whenever the English turn up? What is it about the English that gets the juices going?
I just think you always travel with a massive set of fans.
Yeah.
And it always just creates a real good buzz, a real good atmosphere. You know, recently, West Indies more famed for the T20 heroics, and we are thought of as the Calypso Kings and, you know, carnival cricket and what's not. And I think that kind of atmosphere brings the best out in the team, a lot more so in T20 than in Test cricket. But the atmosphere around the Test series, it really riles you up, and you know something is on the line. And I think whenever you put on the jersey and you represent the badge of West Indies, there's so many sovereign nations that you represent, so many people that you can put smiles on their faces. But when England comes to town, it just raises that up a notch.
That little bit more.
Yeah, it's just a different feeling and a different atmosphere. And it's the 0-4. You always love to get one over England. a lot of nice stories you have heard from past as well. And a lot of guys want to etch their name into that history moving forward. So it's always a nice battle. It's just one of them derbies that you love to be a part of. And I'm sure a lot of the guys will be looking forward to it.
Yeah, and you mentioned a few of those names there as well. we saw a little bit of Kyle Mayers, who came from nowhere, didn't he, and made that amazing double against Bangladesh to kind of nail that series, really, a 2-0 away win. He'll probably be in there, you think, what, 5 or 6, but before him, with Bonner and one or two others, it's a pretty raw, isn't it, and kind of undefined middle order. Do you see that there's enough class in there to bother the English?
Yeah, I think it the order's been a bit stop-start. Yeah. There's not been much consistency. So we've always been searching for that opener to accompany Craig Brathwaite, and I'm sure the English could understand trying to find someone to partner Alistair Cook.
So John Campbell's back in, right?
Yeah,
John Campbell's back in. And Jeremy Solizano has been very unfortunate to miss out. So he replaced John Campbell, got hit feeling at short leg, got injured. I don't think he batted in the only test that he played. I know he's out playing A team, and John is back in after a very good start to first class cricket. So that in itself is a nice little battle. And I think it will be good for West Indies cricket to have those little battles for opening position, number 3, number 4. I'm really excited to see Bonner, Brooks and Kyle Mayers in that middle order. At one point in time or another, they've all proven that they can perform at the highest level, but as I say, we need a complete batting performance. So how can that middle order stitch together a couple half centuries, maybe a century or two, and get West Indies to 300, 350 in the first innings, which we've been struggling to do on a consistent basis?
I wanted to ask you, Carlos, about Kyle Mayers, because I think most would accept he played the test innings of last year, unbelievable innings against Bangladesh.
He got our award, didn't he, in the magazine?
He did. We gave him the innings of the year. Innings of the year awards. But to look at his record, there was no real sign of where that came from. But reading a bit more around him, it sounded like he was an exciting young cricketer in Barbados, and there were high hopes for him, but it just hadn't quite come about. Is he a guy that you know? He's a few years younger than you, but you'd have played with him.
Yeah, I know him quite well, actually. Yeah. His story is such a nice one. So out of West Indies under 19 World Cup, at that point in time, Dwayne Smith would have been smashing it to all parts. Everyone felt that he would have been the next West Indian batsman to play IPL, take the world alight in T20 cricket. He's big, he's burly, smashes it a long way, loves to bat spin, which is something that not many West Indians can claim to do. And he just went off the boil a bit. Barbados, unfortunately for him, has a lot of all-rounders. Myself, Jason Holder, Kevin Stout, Raymond Reefer, the list is endless. So he had to wait behind a few people. He went to the Wainwright Islands, played there for a few years for CPL, for St. Lucia, which is the franchise company in the Windward Islands. And then, unfortunately, when one of the hurricanes hit, he was actually trapped in Dominica. There was no sign or sound from him for a few days, and the cricket fraternity in the Caribbean and in Barbados especially was fearing for the worst. Thankfully, he made it out, and it's almost as though that hit the reset button for him. He came back home. He started to open the batting at club level, and instead of trying to be an all-rounder, he then put a real focus on his batting, which is what got him to that level in the first place. Started to open, started to take his batting more seriously, started to think like a batsman, which I think is very important as well. And it's just been a massive turnaround. The way he plays white ball cricket as an opener in T20 or batting number 3 or 4 in 50 over, the way he's then slotted into number 5 or 6 in 4-day cricket, and almost being that link between the first new ball and the second new ball, and take it apart in the back end as well. It's been a sensational turnaround, and he's the type of character that loves a challenge. You know, when he was selected for the Bangladesh tour, I remember doing an interview with someone, and they were asking me who the guys to look out for in the tour. And I was like, Kyle Mayers, for sure, because he's someone that, having this glimpse of an opportunity, would definitely want to take it. Someone who plays spin very well. And if there was one person that I think can go down there and show the bravado that is necessary to win a series in Bangladesh, it would be him. And I think with this series on the horizon, I know England's spin stocks are not the main thing, but the level of arrogance and confidence that he has in his own game, I'm sure that he isn't happy with what happened after the double century. But I'm sure that if there's one person that would love to give it a go, a proper go in this series, and help Jason Holder, Craig Brathwaite, and the more established names bring the series home, it will be Kyle Mayers.
You must have been feeling pretty smug during that innings then with that prediction. Talk to me about Jaden Seals. He's not played much first-class cricket at all. He's come straight to the West Indies Test side and he's done so well. He was brilliant at that Under-19 World Cup a couple of years ago. How excited are people in the West Indies game about Jaden Seals?
Very excited. I hadn't seen much of him, I'll be honest. And then we saw the World Cup. But there have been a few people that we've tried to take straight up the Under-19 World Cup and shove them into the West Indies team, and has not always worked out. So I just was a little sceptical of how quickly he was fast-tracked. He was fast-tracked, I think, straight into the squad on the England tour for the quote-unquote COVID series. But talking to people in the setup, one, he's really skillful. And I think in the West Indies, aside from Jason Holder, we lack pace bowlers that have pace and have a real genuine skill to swing the ball potentially both ways. And they are saying that he is the most skillful fast bowler in the West Indies apart from Jason. And the other thing that they love about him, he wants to learn. He's always asking, how can he get better? Apparently him and Kumar Roach are getting very close. And if we talk about skill again, Kumar is a man that's very skillful. Surrey would have been fortunate enough to have him on the books last season. But he's always seeking information. So for a young person to come into international cricket the way that he has, without that foundation of first-class cricket, to not only get the start that he has, but not let it get to his head and actually try to get bigger and better as you go on. I think he's a name that we'll hear for a number of years.
I guess something that's quite similar about both England and West Indies is how different both squads are between Test cricket and T20 cricket. I think only Holder and Mayers featured in both squads for this double England tour at the start of this year. Why is that the case now? I mean, there are some like really obviously incredibly talented batters outside the Test squad at the moment. Like Nicholas Puran has not played much first-class cricket, but he looks like he's a player who could have the game to thrive in Test cricket. Shimron Hetmyer, he last played Test cricket when he's only 22. Is it really difficult for a young West Indian batter in particular, maybe, to forge a career in both at the moment?
That's a very good question.
he gets them out sometimes.
Yeah. there's not a regular occurrence. it is a very good question, because off the field, there's a big disparity between what an English player can earn just playing county cricket in all three formats, and as a result of that, honing the red ball skill in the county championship, versus what a West Indian player can earn only playing in the West Indies. So a lot of players have had to use the pathway of first class cricket, one day cricket, CPL, to make it into franchise cricket, to then be able to get some financial security. And you can find yourself in a trap where you're flying all around the world and then not playing first class cricket. And I am one of the persons that could safely say that I fell into the trap. No regrets, but you can definitely see the drop off in my batting from when I was playing red ball cricket, first class cricket, test cricket, versus when I wasn't. I think my last first class game was a test match in 2016. So there's 6 years now. And if you compare that to, let's say, a Chris Wokes or Ben Stokes, to any of the guys that play for England now, they always have county championship to come back to. And I think red ball is a real nice reset to assist and to provide a foundation for your white ball game. Unfortunately, as I said, with the financial disparity, not a lot of players can take the time off to spend 4 or 5 months in the Caribbean, leave out franchise cricket to only play a red ball. So unless we find a way where we can keep the Shimron Hetmyers and Nicholas Puran's bank account happy. I know it doesn't sound good, but it is the world we live in. You need to have that financial security. And it's not always about money, but length of contract as well. You can sign a 3-4 year deal in England. In the West Indies, it's always a 1 year rolling contract. So you get injured at the wrong point in time, you could be without a contract for the next 12 months. And if everyone performs, that could easily roll on to 24 months. And you marry that to someone that has a 3 year contract, they can miss a whole season and still know that for the next 2 years, they'll be employed. They'll be able to do their craft. So unless we can find a way to ensure financial security in the West Indies alone, it'll be difficult to keep players that are good in the white ball game, to keep them playing first class cricket and then ultimately pushing for a test play.
I think there's there's often, and perhaps less so these days, but there's been an impression, not just in the Caribbean, but in England too, that players almost turn their back on Test cricket and focus on T20. But do you think actually the desire is there more than people necessarily think? So take Kieran Pollard as an example. I interviewed him a few months ago, and he said very early doors, he was told by the board, by the selectors, that they saw him as a white ball player and sort of pushed him in that direction. Fast forward a few years, he gets a lot of criticism for being, you know, a mercenary, a white ball player. But actually, those choices don't, perhaps aren't quite as clear as they might seem from the outside looking in.
Yeah, well, the same thing happened to me. I remember, obviously, leading into that, remember the name and the World Cup final. My 2015 was first class cricket, ODI cricket, red ball cricket with Barbados, or with the A team, or touring with the West Indies. And it provided a really good platform that when it was then called up for the World Cup, I had batting behind me where I batted a lot of balls, left the World Cup, played probably one test after that, and then got handed the T20 captaincy and basically shunted to the side in red ball cricket. And a lot of times selectors or the public at large basically say, okay, you failed in red ball, you're a white ball player. But actually, I think more players appreciate Test cricket than the current playing group is given credit for. Mm-hmm. But sometimes persons are pigeonholed from public or selectors that they are white ball cricketers. I mean, you're pushed in that direction. The financial ramifications of trying to push back to go into something that's less lucrative in red ball, longer and more difficult, versus saying, okay, well, if I try to play a red ball and you don't want me, I'll just go and play white ball cricket, play all around the world, experience privileges that not a lot of people get, fly first class, live in the best hotels, meet people from all around the world, different cultures. When a player eventually does that for a year or two, then people say, well, why does he want to play first class cricket? But 2 years ago, he wanted to. And he wasn't afforded the opportunity to. So sometimes it's looking at the holistic view of what the player has been through, how people view the player, how he's been pigeonholed, and then why his ultimate decision to play franchise cricket was decided. But at the same time, franchise cricket is a blessing. You look at the England white ball team, I guess you call them the COVID team as well. They had to pick a whole new squad. Yeah. They played against Pakistan. They beat Pakistan, Pakistan's first team. But if that squad was 15 players, about 8 of them had played PSL. So they've come into international cricket, making a lot of the debuts or playing in the second series, but they're seasoned enough playing against that level of competition because of franchise cricket. So I think there's still ways to use franchise cricket as an avenue to get players ready for first-class cricket. It's not international cricket versus franchise cricket, but I think there needs to be a little more dialogue around who plays what, why they play, when they play, etc., to ensure that the territories, the franchise teams, and the players get the best outcome for all parties involved.
Mm. How did you feel in 2016 when you were told that? Because people might not know this, but you played 3 test matches and you averaged 45 with a bat. That's pretty good. And being told that Red Bull wasn't a viable option that time when you got the T20 captaincy. How do you feel at the time about that?
Yeah, well, it was disappointing because I love Test cricket. I didn't bowl well. So as much as my average with the bat is sensational, my average with the ball is just as ridiculous in the opposite direction. But my thing was at the time, and I think around that time, you had the situation with Stokes, Wokes and Ali, where I think Moeen Ali was batting at 6 and Stokes at 8, and they swapped them because they wanted Stokes to be a batting all rounder, Wokes to be bowling all rounder, and Moeen Ali to be spinning all rounder. And my thought at the time was, why not bat me at 6? I'm obviously doing well with the bat. It allows you to play an extra bowler. If I don't do well with the ball again, then you can drop me. Or if I don't do well with the bat, you can drop me. But dropping me because I'm not doing well with the ball when I'm obviously doing better than the top order with the bat doesn't make much sense. And obviously, as I mentioned, as a team, West Indies aren't proficient over a period of time as a batting unit. So I think for me, that was one of the more frustrating things. And then fast forward a bit after we had a tour to Pakistan, I didn't play. And then I actually gave up a CPL contract to try to be in the reckoning for the England tour, which is directly after Pakistan. And I wasn't even told I was not part of the tour. I have a cricket company and one of the boys came to get the bats fixed up for the tour. And it was like, so you were selected? And he was like, yeah, I got your call. So that was their thing, like, why I get a call to say yes or no? So there's a lot of things like that happen that then it made me ask myself, well, do I really want to play first class cricket, leave out potential to travel around the world, meet new people, experience new cultures, be paid handsomely for it, really slogging away in Barbados or in the West Indies playing four-day cricket without any sort of dialogue to say if I'm still in the setup or not, or shall I just play franchise cricket and if the opportunity presents itself, play some four-day? And I chose the latter, obviously, but that could have gone so differently. Like, Carlos, what is your opinion? What do you want to do? And then how can we best ensure that you get enough red ball cricket to try to get back into the team whilst allowing you to go around the world, play, get some financial security, and ultimately continue to add to your skills because you are a part of the white ball team. And I think a lot of those conversations need to be had.
For context as well, for our listeners, those three test matches that Carlos played, they weren't against weaker nations as well. That was 59 against Australia at the MCG, 69 against Australia at the SCG, and then a half century against India, and then that's your lot. Which, you know, give it.
That's it.
Yeah.
Which, so another 31 runs at the SCG, you would not be sitting here.
Yeah, I look back on my time in Test cricket fondly. With the ball, obviously not as exciting, but it was part of a bowling attack that was struggling. I think in those three tests, we took 9 wickets in total. So my 1 wicket in those three tests, as bad as it is, and it is really bad, when you look at how the team was, it was about par for the course as fourth bowler. But I love Test cricket, and I think a lot of players do love Test cricket. It is a fantastic test of mental skills, tactical skills, physical as well. And yeah, I think the public doesn't appreciate how much players actually love Test cricket. It's very hard. It's a grind and players moan all the time, but players will still throw the test stats at you like nothing. Your first class stats, like there's nobody's business. So there is a place for Test cricket, I think. It just needs to compare, one, financially with your franchise and your white ball cricket. And secondly, the weaker nations or the nations with less financial ability need to be propped up in some way. Because if we just talk about the numbers of it, an Australian guy can play for 20,000 Australian per test match. I think the English player for what, 18, 20,000 pounds a test match. If one of the West Indies are going out there and fielding for 2 days watching Joe Root or Steve Smith score a double, and you're getting 5,000-6,000 US, that's a big disparity. If you can go and play in franchise cricket for the amount of money that they play for in test cricket, there are not many people that would choose to play 5 days for less money than they would to play 4 T20 games for the same amount of money. So it's not all about money. It never is and it never will be, but it also needs to make sense. Test cricket is very hard mentally, physically, and the payment needs to reflect the grind that Test cricket is. And it does reflect it for Indian cricketers, English cricketers, Australian cricketers. And that's what you can see. Those teams put the best teams out at every moment. But it's a lot more difficult for your Pakistan, Sri Lanka, West Indies, etc.
If we're looking further down the line, though, and everyone who loves Test cricket has a soft spot for West Indies Test cricket, obviously, right? They're everybody's second team. It's the only team where, when they play against the English, I don't mind who wins, right? And I'm not just saying that to be nice. But looking at it 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, the only way that we can envision a world where the West Indies are even barely equivalent to what they were in the 70s and the 80s is if the real talents coming through, the likes of Pooran, the likes of Hetmyer, it can't be beyond the wit of man that we find a system, find a way where they can simultaneously develop as a white ball cricketer and also maintain their skills in red ball cricket as well. Because we've seen it with Pakistanis, which is a good comparison. Socioeconomically, it's a good comparison. But we've seen it that there are players who you know, are very busy white ball cricketers, but it's not to the detriment of their red ball cricket either. There seems to be more of a division in West Indies cricket, I suppose, at the moment. And I can and you articulate what the reasons why brilliantly, but there's always going to be that hinge point, right, for West Indies cricket going forward in the test game if some of its most naturally talented young players are veered away from the Red Bull at that early point and kind of effectively asked to make that choice, because then you're always going to be hamstrung. I'm not saying that Pooran necessarily would have been a good test match player, but the frustration is we'll never know, will we, really? It's almost certainly that we'll never know. And the next Pooran, the 18-year-old, you know, stroke maker in Trinidad or whatever, coming out, you know, who's got all the talent in the world, it would be a travesty if he gets to 22, 23, and he's kind of forced to say, right, you go one way or you go the other way. Because we've seen with other countries that you can kind of go both, for all the reasons that you outlined, the problems that are therein. But if we're looking at the dream of the West Indies becoming the dominant Red Bull power that they once were, then we need to find a way through this, right?
But I also think if you look back on the West Indies glory years, a lot of players would have played in South Africa, first class cricket. A lot of players played county cricket
over here,
as well.
For sure, yeah.
So in that ideal world, how can we allow players, obviously there's now an international window of sorts for IPL, so that's one way of making money on the franchise scene. You have to play a CPL, you have to play a franchise tournament in a Red Bull, whether that be at home, in England, Australia, right, wherever, and then you have one other window in the world to do whatever you want to do. But how can we ensure that you get your white ball in IPL, you get your white ball at home, CPL, that's home drum beats first, and then you need to get in at least one Red Bull season somewhere in the calendar, and everything else is yours. And if the West Indies Cricket Board can find a way to have that flexibility in the calendar, it allows, one, for players to go away and earn money, but it allows them to also concentrate on Red Bull over a season, not a couple of games.
Yeah.
You're picking a season, either the West Indian season, the English season, wherever, and you play that whole season, 6 to 10 games, whatever. It will not only help their white ball, but it also help build a collection of players that West Indies can eventually choose from. And you may easily find there are two players that decide to go to Sri Lanka to play first class, two have decided to go to Australia. Now, when we're looking for a team to go to Sri Lanka, obviously those two players come to the fore before two guys that were playing in the West Indies, mm-hmm, and likewise Australia, New Zealand, etc. But I think it needs to be length of contract as well. So I can't tell you, I'll contract you for a year, you can make this decision, then you get injured or it don't go the way you would like, and then you're on the outside. Because then the next year, I can tell myself, with a survival mentality, I need to find a way to survive, whether in the West Indies, out of the West Indies, red ball, white ball or not. So if it's a case where it's not about survival and it's more about excellence, where, okay, we believe in you. You have a 3-year window to do this, to do that. We need to see X, Y, Z. And after those 3 years, we could reevaluate. Then that is financial security. That is job security. And that's a way to plan moving forward.
And also, psychologically, as a cricketer as well, you can't play if it's a hand-to-mouth, week-to-week kind of existence. You know, cricket's the hardest game mentally to play anyway. So you need that kind of security of knowing that you're trusted and backed. And it taps into something that struck me over the last few years. How many West Indian cricketers you hear about, get excited about, and then a year or two later, their names are gone and you're on Crick Info and it's they've like vanished into the ether somewhere. And it seems to tap into what you're saying here, that there's a sort of precariousness around the professional game in the West Indies, especially as a young player.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have a story to share similar to that. I was contracted by Barbados Cricket Association, and then at that point in time, they had the High Performance Centre. I got asked to join the High Performance Centre. I was elated. Joined the High Performance Centre to have to give up my contract with Barbados. When that contract finished, the Barbados contracts hadn't finished as yet, so I was between contract, and then I got injured just before the season. So then now I don't have a contract, and I am injured, and I can't play to earn another contract. You get no money, no one really looks after you, and you're basically on the outside looking in, trying to find a way. That increases your survival instincts. So all of a sudden, my mentality will be, I need to find a way to get back in. I need to find a way to make a life for myself. I need to find a way to make it as a professional cricketer. If you compare that to someone like Pat Cummins, who made his debut at 18, we heard nothing about Pat Cummins for, what, 3, 4, 5 years?
But they kept him in the system.
Kept him in the system, looked after him, and now he's Australia Test captain. Now, I'm not by any stretch of imagination saying that I could be West Indies Test captain if I had been treated like Pat Cummins. But what about the next guy?
Sure.
Who have we lost in the system that could have been a Pat Cummins, who, if we'd invested in for 2, 3, 4 years, could now be leading the West Indies, leading the attack, leading the batting, etc. We've lost Jofra, we've lost CJ, we've lost Bethel, maybe Shea Simmons. Who will be next? And how can we stop them from escaping the system, but using those persons to build a bigger pool of players?
Yeah, I want to ask Carlos about the batting specifically, kind of going back to this series. And I think we've been talking about this on previous podcasts. I think we're all expecting it to be quite a low-scoring series with two really good bowling attacks and two kind of struggling batting units. But it struck me over the last few years when West Indies players come into the Test squad, the batters, their first-class records aren't great. They're generally averaging kind of low 30s, even high 20s, a couple of them. Is that a reflection on the pitches, first-class cricket in general, or is there not the batting talent that you would hope to see in the Caribbean at the moment?
I think a bit of both. On one hand, I think we do mature very late as cricketers in the Caribbean. And as a result of that, you find your players, when they reach 31, 32, 33, they now actually understand the game a lot more. But then they're 31, 32, 33, and looking for the next fresh face, 19 or 20-year-old. Added to that, the pitches aren't the best, so they're quite slow, not conducive to good stroke play, which is why you see a lot of hitters, because on a slower track, on a track that's not the best, the ball is in your zone, you stroke it through extra cover, you could be run up coming for one. Whereas if you hit that ball for six, you know you got your six. So I think a combination of the pitches not being the best, the outfields potentially could be a lot better and quicker as well. So you want that when a guy plays an elegant cover drive like your Shamar Brooks or your Shea Hope, that he get full value for the money. That encourages the next guy to try to play another cover drive. But if I cover driving the ball and I sprinting for one or two to not get a run out versus someone who can smash that same ball over cover for six, I know which one they can try to do. So I think it's been a combination of both. The umpiring hasn't been the best either. But a few times we've seen like real flat tracks to prepare. And I think going into series, when we find that, it improves the batsmanship. It forces players now to not only graft hard for 20 or graft hard for 30, but because the pitches are so good, you get out at 20 and see someone else going to make 130, 140. You think, crap, when I get my chance in the second innings, I can't give it away. So I think if the pitches can become slightly more batting friendly, it allows the bowlers to work a bit harder. The spinners don't think as though they're world beaters because the tracks are bad, and the batsmen put a bigger price on the wicket. They get more value for the shots, and I think the whole cricket ecosystem could be a lot better, and it has been in the last few years.
Kind of reassuring to hear that problems with first-class pitches is
and
not
umpires.
A problem.
Yeah,
and
umpires.
You're going to be talking about county cricket there.
Yeah. And moving on to the England warm-up game. We're recording this at the start of the third day of England's four-day warm-up game. They're playing a reasonably strong cricket West Indies President's 11 that features five players who played Test cricket for the West Indies. England are going pretty well so far. Five of their new-look top six reached 50 with Johnny Bairstow going on to score 100. Phil, you wrote a very nice piece on wisdom.com about this new look England top seven, of whom only two started in the Ashes, at the very start of the Ashes.
Yeah, do you have a question there?
No, I just thought you were going to talk about
your
piece.
Nice piece. Well done, yeah. Phil, is the question.
That's often what you do. You just talk about the piece you've
written. I guess so, yeah. Just giving you an excuse to talk.
I guess so. Yeah, look, I mean, it'll probably all go to shit, but I like it. I like the balance. There's a sort of light and shade to it. There's a bit of variety. I like, overall, that they've split up Root and Stokes. We talked about the number three slot last week. You know that I'm comfortable with Root there. I think it's sensible. And Lawrence, I'm pleased on a personal level because, you know, I know the lad a bit and I'm a big fan of his. I'm pleased that he's going to have first go there. I think it's right and fair. Pope played at least three, maybe four of the test matches in Australia and didn't go well and hasn't as struggled as we know. So I think Lawrence in at four is fair. He played impishly yesterday for 80-odd. The opening bats make sense as well. You know, there's a left and right thing going on there. There's the youngish hitter and the experienced, slightly kind of gnarly county cricket stalwart in Alex Lees, who's been playing the best part of a decade and has kind of grafted his way to a position where he probably has earned this chance. He looked okay for 60-odd, scratched around a bit on a sort of turgid kind of track.
I think he was on like four after an hour.
Yeah, but look, it's what we're crying out for. And Crawley looked good as well. You know, Crawley always looks good until he gets out. He's that kind of cricketer, Zach Crawley. But I like I like the rhythm of that top seven. We spoke about Folks as well. A couple of weeks ago, Folks took the gloves in this game, so I almost certainly this will be the top seven next week in Antigua. And yeah, cautiously, I like the setup. I like the thinking behind it. Whether it will work or not is another thing, of course, but I like it.
You answered my non-question very well.
Thank you.
as we predicted, Joe, the bowling attack for that warm-up game is the one that took the field at Brisbane plus Craig Overton. So much for that brave reset. Tom asked, the podcast is brilliant. I listen every week without fail and it has really helped me understand the game better as I've only really followed cricket since the start of the 2019 World Cup. Thanks again for your hard work getting the podcast out every week. I look forward to listening. He asks, basically... Yeah, he's nice, isn't it? He's very nice. He basically asked, it makes sense to play Mahmood and or Fisher to give them exposure at this level in this series, given they've been picked. But there's a kind of problem in that with this England tail, Chris Wokes almost needs to play because the tail is so long.
Yeah, I think Wokes does need to play. I mean, we've touched on this before with the lack of England's bowlers don't really bat at the moment. Wokes is the standout all-rounder or bowling all-rounder. So I think he does need to play. There is something very odd that we're going to go into the start of this series with the same bowling attack that we kind of threw our heads up in despair after England picked it at Brisbane. But, you know, this is a different situation. Anderson Broad are not there now, so it is a different conversation. I think I would be tempted to... I think Mahmood should play a test at some point in this series. I suspect Fisher is a little bit further back in the queue and is there for kind of experience to be in amongst the group. We might not see him in this series. But as slightly odd as it is, I don't have any problems if that is the bowling attack they're going to go with in the first test.
Will it turn, Carlos, next week?
It always turns.
Yeah. Because this seems to be the properties of pitches now in the West Indies. They do seem to go. They're quite dry and they seem to go after a day or two.
Yeah, you may even get it on your first day, but it won't rag on your first day. The pitches, especially at Civiv, it is flat.
Yeah, yeah.
It will definitely rag. It'll be a little bit slow as well. But I think Civiv is one of the better cricket wickets for Test cricket in the Caribbean. When you get to Kensington Oval, there'll be a bit of bounce. There'll be a bit of something in it. A throwback to Fire in Babylon.
I would love that.
But I think Civiv track is a nice one to start the series. Players can get in. Bowlers, if you bowl well, you get a bit of something out of it. Batters, if you put a price on your wicket, you can get a score.
It's a massive series for Leach, isn't it? We've kind of... wondered if Parkinson might leapfrog him, and then I think most of us thought Leach does deserve a proper go, given, you know, he got picked on the wrong pitches in the Ashes. But if there is a bit in it for the spinners, as we expect there to be, and it doesn't go well for him, then that could potentially be terminal for his Test career, given that England haven't seemed to have a lot of faith in him. But flip side, if he goes well, then he comes back to England installed as their first choice spinner. I think they're going to play a spinner much more regularly than they did under Silverwood. And then it could be a kind of rejuvenation point for Leach. So it really is. It feels like this is kind of potentially make or break for his career. And I really hope it goes well for him, because he's had, whether it's injuries, selection,
illness,
he's had a horrible run for the last couple of years. And he deserves a break or two.
It's such a weird career so far. He's done actually pretty well in the one home summer that he selected, but hasn't played a home test for now nearly 3 years.
Do you know where Stokes' bowling fitness is at?
He's been bowling in the lunch breaks and stuff.
He's got a side strain, isn't it, that he's recovering from, or had a side strain?
Yeah, but he's bowling in the... Yeah.
So it's unlikely that he's going to bowl more than a couple of overs at best, and by the sounds of it, which precludes, therefore, having a second spinner, you know, which would have been a long shot anyway. But I guess if you're going to play two, it would be on a flat one at Antigua, when one is going to be ragging it, in theory at least, away from the right-hander. But if Stokes is not going to be able to get through 15, 20 a day, then that's overs, not fans, by the way.
could be interesting. This podcast will be coming out after the third day. If Leach has a really, really good day today, that might change their thinking a little bit. They think it's going to spin more than they previously thought.
They'll rely on Root, though, won't they?
Yeah.
I can't see them playing Parkinson and Leach. Yeah.
And also, really, we can't ask for much more, right? We've got five of the top seven from Brisbane are no longer there. We've got a new opening pair. We've got Lawrence in at four. We can't ask for too much. Parkinson, bless him. I know that he's your boy, but bless him. His time will yet come.
Well,
just finally, you're going to he's going to Barbados next week or the week after, right? Him and the other lad who's normally on the show there.
So Yaz will be in Barbados and you'll be stuck in a studio
working
for BT. Well, cosmically wrong about that.
Well, hopefully for Matt Parkinson's debut, seeing that live in the flesh, that'd be
fun. Yeah, dream on. But I guess my question, though, What will he find in terms of the atmosphere around the ground as well as in it, in Barbados, the epicentre of cricket, right? You know, there is no more fertile place on earth for having produced great cricketers, from, you know, the three W's to the Sobers to Greenwich to Haynes to yourself to Marshalls. You know, you can go on forever.
It is an abomination to put my name in that list.
If you watch it on YouTube, you might see me wink there. But anyway, you know, does it retain its sort of symbolic attachment to cricket? You know, and the soul of Caribbean cricket remains in Barbados. And is it as strong now as it was when you were a kid?
Yeah, it's always as strong. And with England coming, there will be a buzz. All the vendors will know.
Yeah.
The stock, little 20% extra. the tourists are in town. And there will be a buzz. Too. And if you get a taxi, the taxi man will know who should play, who should not play, why X isn't playing, want to know why Y isn't playing. He'll probably even tell you a lot about English cricket and English cricketers. Now, there's still a massive buzz around in Barbados, and I'm sure everything will be centered around ensuring that the English tourists are very well looked after, that they feel comfortable. And we understand that when we turn up to a game in Barbados, and it's England v West Indies, that we're going to feel as though we are the away team. And everyone loves it. There'll be a pool, I'm sure. You get your shirt off, you get a nice tan, you drink some rum and cokes, enjoy the cricket.
Sounds pretty good, actually. Yeah. Sounds pretty good.
That's enough. Let's move on. Yeah. Come on, let's move on.
I'm taking one for the team by going. Next up, we'll talk about the Women's World Cup. The Women's World Cup would have started by the time this comes out. You can go back to last week's pod for our big fat preview of the tournament. Since the last pod, there have been some interesting warm-up game results. New Zealand pulled out a real statement win over Australia, chasing down 322 with 9 wickets and 7 overs in hand. Sophie Devine scored an unbeaten 161, and the in-form Amelia Kerr an unbeaten 92.
Yeah, that's a big one, that, isn't
but
it?
But a couple of days before that, they lost against Pakistan. It wasn't quite a full-strength New Zealand side. There was no Amelia Kerr for one, but Pakistan chased down 229 the last over. Alia Riaz hit 62 off 52 from number 7. Kind of shows that any of the teams can beat anyone, and at least capable of, at the very least, influencing who reaches the final four. India have won 2 warm-up games since we last recorded. One against South Africa by 2 runs, in West Indies by about 80 runs. Harmanpreet Kaur has found some form. She scored 100 against South Africa. Carlos, got a question for you from one of the listeners. David asks, whose name does Carlos think we will remember after the Women's World Cup? And see what he's done there.
Cheeky.
Cheeky, very cheeky. I like Amelia Kerr. I think she's probably one of the next big superstars in the women's game. But I'm hoping, and I'm being very biased, Hayley Matthews will be the name that we remember. She had a very inspiring performance in the finals in 2016 to bring West Indies the only T20 World Cup victory. And I think she's kind of the prodigy to Stephanie Taylor, bowls off spin, top order bat, and, you know, has the versatility like Stefani does to be able to play the long game, but then also up the tempo. And I think if Stefani does go out there and puts in a all-star performance in the tournament and becomes player of the series, it is something we would expect. But I also think Hayley Matthews has the ability to do the same thing, but probably less expected of her. Thankfully, she showed what she can do in the 100 over last summer, and I'm just hoping that she can take that into the World Cup, put in some performances along with Stefani, along with DeAndre Dotton, the more elder statespersons in the team. That is the backbone to the West Indies batting, in my opinion. And they need all three of them to be at the party more often than not to come close to qualifying and then potentially winning the tournament.
What do you think represents success for West Indies in this tournament? Because we talked in our preview last week, we said the players they've got, we can see them pulling off a couple of big shocks, beating the best sides in the tournament, but may struggle for the consistency to get into that top four, into the semi-finals. Is a semi-final spot, would that be the aim, or is it, they just go into it and say we can win this?
Yeah, I think that's the first aim. I think West Indies are good knockout and tournament teams. We're not the best team when it comes to series, so the consistency definitely leaves us, and that's not something that we can say is our benchmark. But we have the players that can win a couple of games and qualify, And then you have those same players that can put in two big performances in a semi and a final and win the tournament. So I think saying we'll go there and we'll win is a step too far. But by the same token, if the first step is to actually qualify, once they do get to the semis, I would back them to have two good performances. Yeah.
Interesting. The PSL final happened last weekend. I was completely hooked. The end result wasn't that close, but the atmosphere in the ground was incredible. Just like totally unlike anything you'd see in a game in the UK. Lahore Qalandars won it, meaning that all six sides in the PSL have won the competition in its seven-year history. With my England hat on, Harry Brook played a brilliant innings, 41 off 22. He's just really calm. Like, he was happy to be 8 off 9, kind of backed himself to accelerate at the end. It was quite a tricky, quite a slow wicket. And he's only just turned 23. His record at the death is amazing. His record against pace is amazing. I was a bit sceptical about his T20I call-up for the West Indies series because he had a quite difficult Big Bash season, but as Ben Duckett said on last week's show, that can be really difficult going into these leagues as a young overseas pro. But it's made me think, like, he's the person who's going to end Owen Morgan's career at one point or another. I'm not saying that should happen now, but he's a natural heir, I think, to bat 5 or 6 in that England T20 side. And he had an amazing PSL, amazing 100, amazing blast in 2021 and in 2020. He's built up a really formidable set of numbers in T20 cricket.
It'll be interesting to see how Morgan handles this himself, because he's not the sort of bloke that's going to hang around if he doesn't think he's worth his place on the side. He's too sensible, pragmatic, proud for that. And if there is someone like Harry Brook coming through that can fulfil that role, and there aren't that's a tricky role. With England are awash with opening options, but that middle order option, they're few and far between. That's why they attract so much money when it comes to the franchise tournaments. But if he is starting to look like he can fulfil that role, Morgan might think, well, maybe this is the time to take one step aside.
Carlos used the word arrogant earlier about young players coming through and how it's quite a key marker. Brook has that. It just oozes off him. And he had that reputation as well, actually, when he was a teenager. He was England under-19s captain and, you know, cock of the walk. And he's taken that kind of attitude into his Yorkshire career. Bit of a breakout summer last year in the 100. Obviously, he's got the nod now for England. And you see it. You see that in a player. You see it a mile off, and he has that. He has that kind of big match sort of sparkle to him.
Have you seen much of Brook in the 100?
Yeah, he was part of the team that knocked my Manchester Originals for 200.
Sorry to bring that up there.
And yeah, playing for Birmingham Bears last year, we played against them a couple of times, and I think we shot them out for like 90 odd. At home at Edgbaston, and he was just a rock. He was very difficult to dislodge, and it's just something about the way that he sets up. I think he is your typical modern dynamic player, someone who I think, I guess, I don't know, his stats would either back me up or say otherwise, but he looks like someone that can bat at 6 in red ball cricket and be a link between the new ball, the first new ball, if the team is in trouble, be able to graft it out. And if the team is in a good position, really play that Adam Gilchrist role where you put the opposition under pressure, leading straight into the second new ball. But by the same token, he could bat at 3, 4, 5, or 6 in white ball cricket.
That's bang on, by the way. It's exactly how it's played out for him. His red ball record's not great in terms of, you know, average and stats, but he's played important innings at certain points. You know, he made a breakout 100 at Chelmsford against Essex a couple of years back, and he made a couple of key innings last year as well in red ball cricket, kind of game changing innings.
And he had a good, his overall record last year was good.
Yeah,
it was decent, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and it's getting better all the time.
Yeah.
On Lahore, Carlos, you had a interesting backstory to their success.
Yeah, so when Lahore came in to PSL, they had all the biggest names. One of the smaller of those biggest names to pass through Lahore would be Carlos Brathwaite. but, you know, Dwayne Bravo, Sunil Narine, Brendan McCullum, A.B. de Villiers, all those big names that have passed through Lahore Qalandars. And I think for the first 4 episodes, they finished dead last each time. Since then, they would have had more humble names. With all due respect to the names they're about to call, your Ben Dunks, your Samit Patels, your David Visas, who are very admirable cricketers in their own right, but wouldn't command the same attention that the other names would. they've gone away and they've done a lot of scouting with fast bowling. So Harris Rowe would have come through their academy. Shaheen Afridi would have been brought through with Lahore Qalandars. And it's a real nice mesh of just going back to the drawing board, really building something from the ground up. I think they were in the finals year before last. And now winning it this year. So it's a real turnaround from having all the star names, all the star quality and finishing last. And I don't think it was the fault of any of the big names. It's just how it happened, to now going back to drawing board, having more humble names, building on what I felt when I was there as a real good family atmosphere from the owners to the staff, to the players, and eventually winning. So a very nice story in how you can build from the ground up, believe in the process, and eventually be successful.
And they had a really good young quick called Zaman Khan, who they put a lot of trust in, bowled important overs, quite slingy. And yeah, really, Shaheen clearly really backed him. It's another little bit of England franchise news. Jason Roy has pulled out of the IPL, citing bubble fatigue. He's taking a short break from the game.
And he won't be starting this summer with
Surrey. No, so he's not playing for Surrey in the early stages of the county championship. Either Pakistan Australia would also have started by the time this pod is released. The first 3 days are a sellout at Rawalpindi, which is amazing. Naseem Shah is back in the Pakistan squad after Harris Ralph caught COVID. It's the first time Australia have toured Pakistan for a test series since 1998, when Mark Taylor was captain, Cameron Green wasn't born yet, and Australia had only won one men's 50 over World Cup. Phil, dare I ask, what were you up to in November 98?
That was my first winter at university.
Leave that there.
Yeah, I think best to move swiftly on. Oh, Jamie Smith.
Not the Surrey keeper.
He's probably born around then.
Taha's out there, isn't he?
Taha is out there.
So you're going to Barbados. So you asked me what I was doing back then, and then you asked me about the cricket. All right, fine. Okay, fair enough. So you and Ben are off to Barbados.
Yeah.
Taha's off to Pakistan, yeah. Or is in Pakistan,
yeah.
And Phil and I,
and
just
we're off
what,
to the Hanover down the road.
Just hold the fort here.
That should be a really good series, really good season. We'll have Taha on after each of those three tests.
It's great this sellout as well, because when they first returned Test cricket to Pakistan a year or so ago,
there was no one there.
It was slightly odd, wasn't it? The first Test match, it was kind of eerily empty. After
the weather was really bad as
It was really smoggy and quite chilly. So it's great that it's going to be a sellout, and photos of the pitch. Road, absolute road, but that's
so
probably a good
be.
Thing as
and
well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think you want to see a game go the distance there as well, and you know, a lot of pace through the air both sides. So, look, should be an absolute belter. It's on Sky as well for our UK listeners. So it should be good.
Saf could beat New Zealand to level the series over there. Carlos, Joe at the start of the series predicted a really close series, which didn't look like a very good prediction off the first game, but it's proven right.
Roundly mocked, one.
Yeah.
I think.
And then you were really looking forward to the third test.
Yeah, I did, I have to say. Look, my attention has been elsewhere, I will admit. But I was really excited about the third test, which unfortunately is not happening. It was a two-test series. Which, you know, a one all-test series, that's pretty nip and tuck, as I said, I think.
Absolutely. And
even if it was two quite convincing wins for different sides.
It's a really good few months for Africa, beating India at home and then drawing against New Zealand. There was quite an interesting tweet from Tim Wigmore, who said that a lot of people said when New Zealand got to the World Test Championship final last time, that part of the reason they got there was because they had loads of two test series, which is easier, was the argument. But actually, their winter just gone shows how hard it is to, you can't slip at any point. You need to win every single match if you've got those two test series, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yes, good point.
Elsewhere, Bangladesh ended up winning that ODI series we talked about last week against Afghanistan 2-1. In the last game, Ramanullah Gurbaz scored 100 for Afghanistan. Only Paul Sterling and Quinton de Kock have scored more men's ODI 100s before turning 21 than Gurbaz. Moving on, Carlos, your Twitter bio reads, professional cricketer, entrepreneur, Man United fan, we'll gloss over that, and NFT enthusiast. I think it's fair to say that a lot of our listeners will have heard about NFTs without really knowing what they are, but this is a real passion of yours. You've got a qualification in this area, I believe. So first off, what is an NFT and why are you interested in them?
So firstly, what an NFT is not, is just a picture of an ape.
I was going to ask that later.
So it stands for non-fungible token. And I guess to not get too technical, it's literally a digital representation of something, and it's verified by something called the blockchain. So you think about the persons that would have loved Pokemon cards or sports cards. If I wanted to get a sports card from you, I have no way of ensuring that it's authentic. The blockchain does that for us. They allow us to authenticate, verify owners. They verify the marketplace that you buy it from. And they also tell you what it was sold for before, and you can see a full history. So you can't trick the blockchain. And I think that is where NFTs are worth the weight in gold. The rise of NFTs have been because of art. So it's allowed creators, whether it be artists, singers, whatever, to be able to monetize their creation. So no longer is someone doing a nice painting and hoping to sell it in a market. They're now putting it on the blockchain, selling it as an NFT. They can do auctions. And what's also nice about that is if they sell it today for $10 because they're no one, and in 10 years they blow up and it's on the size of the Mona Lisa, they get no proceeds from the secondary sale. With NFTs, if you're a singer, artist, whatever, you put your creation out and today it's worth $10, you sell it for that. But in the smart contract, you can write in that you can get 5, 10, 15% of secondary sales. So in 5 years, you become very massive. Everyone knows your name, your household name, and now your production is worth 10, 20, 50 times what you sold it for. You always get a percentage of the secondary income in perpetuity.
I've seen one going around of Ravi Bhopal with his trousers down from the 100. That's quite funny. As I said at the start, you've got a lot of expertise in this area, and a lot of people, myself included, have read articles about environmental concerns around NFTs, that when the blockchain is mined, my technical terminology might be off here, that is bad for the environment. A lot of carbon is offloaded. And there's also kind of this confusion around what you mentioned earlier. No one understands why is John Terry flogging these apes, and why are they valued so much? So one, are those environmental concerns legitimate? And two, what are these digital apes?
So the environmental concerns, it all started with Bitcoin and the blockchain. You had to do proof of work. So in order to log something on the blockchain and for it to be verified, you would spit out a mathematical equation, and whoever solves it first have won the ability to add that block to the blockchain, and then you're rewarded with Bitcoin. That's called proof of work. That is very bad for the environment, and as a result, every cryptocurrency coin since then have gone more to a proof of stake. So we create the coins beforehand, and now the persons who get the opportunity to add the block to the blockchain are the ones who has the most coins, because their stake, they don't want the blockchain to be compromised. So the more invested you are in a coin or in a blockchain, the less you want to be compromised. And as a result, you win the opportunity to mine that block. Crypto.com and a few other platforms have gone carbon neutral. And that is where the space will get to, where persons who don't quite understand NFTs can actually realize, well, this is just like typing www.something into an address bar and actually interacting with an NFT, interacting with a marketplace, and it's not actually killing the environment. So I think the space has evolved in the last 2 to 3 years, and it will continue to evolve with places like crypto.com, who are very well versed internationally in all specters, trying to go as carbon neutral as possible.
And those, why are the apes so popular?
So the apes, again, it's a digital token. So your ape is just a physical or a visual representation of an actual token on the blockchain. So with the apes, they are almost like a ticket to a social club. So you think of your golf clubs or your social clubs where you go in and you have access to a gym and to a coffee club where you meet really interesting people. A lot of important people have bought the apes.
And so, then they're joining this club.
Correct. So if you buy the NFT from Bored Ape Yacht Club and they have a meet in real life, you have the ability to rub shoulders with a Steph Curry or Jimmy Fallon, Eminem, etc. So you're not buying an ape. The ape is a visual representation of your ticket into the Bored Ape Yacht Club fraternity of sorts.
So you have an NFT drop coming out. What's in it? And it's worth saying that as well as the NFTs themselves, there are tangible real life things that are included as well.
Yeah, so I wanted to do an NFT drop on my own to put out some creative artwork. Not as creative as Ravi's pants dung from the 100. But I also wanted to add a charitable component. So I've started a charity in my mum's, or for my mum. So it's named Project Ricky. And we try to support breast cancer initiatives. Unfortunately, she suffered breast cancer. She's in remission now and she's happy and healthy. But while she was going through her ordeal, she really struggled financially to pay for the treatments. So a lot of the breast cancer societies raise awareness, but I've been on the side where awareness is not enough and you actually need physical, tangible cash to be able to get chemo, aftercare, etc. So my aim long term for the charity is for it to be able to give back to persons who are less fortunate, who need chemotherapy, who need aftercare and may come up short. And part of the drop, primary and secondary sales will go towards Project Ricky, which would in some light be able to assist a few people. And I hope it's something that we can do long term and continue to add to the people that can get financial aid. Some of it is a nod to my certificate in financial technology and my Harvard executive course that we've completed in December. And then part of it is Carlos Bradford, the superhero. So just trying to build a community of persons in cricket that may know about NFTs. And there are a lot of people that in cricket that don't know about them. And I just trying to bring NFTs to the cricket fraternity, allow them to see that it's not just apes. It's not just $100,000 quote unquote money laundering schemes. It has real world utility. And in some way, I try to use my profile and my network to be able to give back to those persons that would have invested in the artwork as well as in the charity.
Really interesting. If you're,
I think I've learned more in the last 6 minutes than I have in the last 6 months trying to figure this
out. I was thinking the same.
Thanks for that, mate.
I think Carlos is maybe the fifth or sixth person who'd explain that to me, and now I finally understand it. We even ran an article in the magazine, which I didn't understand.
Brilliant. If you've got more questions, I'd really recommend the Guardian Football Weekly episode on NFTs. It's about an hour long from about a month or so ago. It's a really balanced explanation and debate around them. I would recommend that. And just lastly, where should people go if they're interested in your drop?
So crypto.com. They've been very good. Again, talk about carbon neutral, caring for the environment. They've invested a lot of money in not only bringing cryptocurrency and breaking down barriers to the normal person who wouldn't understand it, stuff like allowing you to purchase with credit cards and debit cards as opposed to just having to buy crypto and interacting with platforms. And they've gone fully carbon neutral. They've also just renamed or bought the rights for the LA Lakers and Clippers Stadium. They have a big presence in F1. So they're here to stay as a crypto and an NFT platform. And I felt it was best to use that platform because they felt as though they wanted to give back the same way I want to align my interests with the environment and build a community. So crypto.com is where it will be. And they're trying to bring out a whole separate NFT platform. And, you know, if I don't want to shill my own personal Twitter, but aside from the Man United stuff that you wouldn't want to see, I try to, you know, retweet projects, retweet education, join spaces that would talk about education around NFTs, understanding the NFT space is not a space to get a quick cash grab. I think it is where the future lies. Imagine building a house, buying a house and attaching an NFT to it. And then every time that house is sold in perpetuity, you get 1%. I think that's where NFTs will go. So me trying to link the cricket community to understand NFTs and really do some deep dives and research and education around it. Follow me on Twitter, follow crypto.com NFT and really start to understand the blockchain, NFT, cryptocurrency, etc.
Now for some podcast admin. For shows that don't directly follow a match, we will now be releasing episodes from 7 a.m. UK morning time. Unless this announcement is met with widespread backlash. Also, you might have noticed that our adverts are slightly different from this show going forward to how they used to be. Again, if you have particularly strong feelings about that, feel
also free
to
bear
get
in mind
in
that we do have to put food on the table.
Get in touch at podcast@wisden.com. As always, we've had some amazing correspondence with our listeners over the last few weeks, exchanging ideas about how to take the show forward. I've not replied to everyone yet, but I will do soon. All those thoughts and contributions are extremely valued by all of us.
Hear, hear.
Next up, a conversation I had with Shield Berry, the man who has watched more England tests than anyone else, dead or alive. And after that, we'll finish off with a final couple of questions from our listeners. Before we move on, time for something a little bit different this week. Joining us now is Shield Berry, the chief cricket writer of the Daily Telegraph and former Wisden Almanac editor. Shield has a new book out, Beyond the Boundaries, Travels on England Cricket Tours, about the considerable time he spent following England play all around the world. Shield, one of your many claims to fame is that you have supposedly watched more England test matches live than any other living person. Is this true, and how many do you reckon you've watched, and where did it all begin?
Well, living or dead, I think, because John Woodcock told me that I'd watched more than he had, which is good enough for me. He said that he had watched just under 400 England tests, but about 20-odd, maybe 420 in all, given the other, you know, Australia versus West Indies series and whatever he would have covered. So yeah, he sort of passed the mantle on and told me that I'd, having clocked 450 a couple of years ago, that was before COVID, so I haven't seen that many since. I'll never reach 500. I think Richie Beno is the only person who's done 500, and thus it should remain.
So I guess you're also the most qualified man to ask the following question. Was 2021 the worst year you've ever seen from the England Test side?
Oh, gosh, no. No. Let's not rewrite history to that extent. Let's go back to January. I mean, wasn't it glorious in Gaul, those two Test matches? I mean, you could say Sri Lanka were the equivalent of maybe India's second 11 in standard. But still, I mean, those pitches were ragging quite a bit. And for Joe Root to play those, you know, 100, double 100 and 180, I mean, those were those two innings, plus the double 100 in Chennai. I mean, he took the standard of English batsmanship in Asia to a higher level. I mean, KP, Kevin Peterson, had played the most amazing attacking 150 or whatever. In Colombo a few years earlier. That was, you know, the standout innings, along with his 100 in Mumbai, you remember, with Alistair Cook, that masterful partnership. So KP had played a couple of absolutely breathtaking innings, running down the wicket and hitting to all parts. But what Joe Root did in those threes in Asia, only this time last year, was a new level of batsmanship, the batsmanship that Root set out in those three test matches a year ago, was masterly, because of his all forms of sweep were mastered. And don't forget, yeah, that was those three test victories only a year ago made it six overseas test wins in a row for England. So it's not all been darkness.
Mm. You say at the start of the book that there are a few better ways to earn a living than what you've done over the last 45 years or so. I mean, even towards the end of your time touring with England, did you still pinch yourself at how privileged, I guess, you were to do what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. Just waking up every day thinking, yabba-dabba-doo. I did tell the editor that I'd be ready to work for nothing, but nothing more than expenses. But I mean, that's most of the time, because every day of, at least of test cricket, but yeah, almost every day of cricket is something completely novel. You have no idea what is going to happen when you go to the ground on the first morning of a test. The only certainty is it's not going to be exactly the same as any other previous test matches it's played. So it is the most wonderful format. Well, we've had 2,500 tests. And the only time I've felt bored with test cricket, it was not recently at all, but back in 1987, 88, I think it was. England were touring New Zealand, and Richard Hadlee broke down in the first test, and so all New Zealand wanted was a nil-all draw. And England were not in the most... they were so jaded after a very long winter that they weren't in the mood to play much either. And so the second and third tests were so repetitious. I mean, bore draws, and the absence of spirit, vitality, really got to me. The second and third tests were very similar as well. That's the only time I felt cricket being repetitious and dull.
We seem to read an article about the impending death of Test cricket on a near monthly basis. With your experience, how do you think the health of Test cricket is at the moment? Is it something that you worry about in the short or even medium term future?
I was lucky in that I started in the 70s when cricket was getting out of the moribund state as it had been in the 1950s and 60s. And I think if you just go back then, obviously the over rates were higher, but the run rates, you know, two and over was fast. And the amount of tedium, the number of five test series that would be drawn nil all. I mean, not England against other countries, but also, you know, India playing Pakistan. The dullness, the defensiveness, the field placings of cricket in the mid-late 50s till the mid-60s, until the West Indies breathed life into Test cricket. I mean, cricket is a far healthier position than it was then. I mean, sometimes, you know, run rates in Test cricket are almost indistinguishable from what they would be in a one-day international or T20. I mean, it's amazing. So the actual health of Test cricket now on the field, the spectacle, is really treasured. We're really lucky to be around now. Then there's the commercial angle. I mean, whether it can be sold to broadcasters, but, you know, if they're five-day tests, you know, that's a lot of, that's 30 hours of television. So I think there's always going to be somebody out there. It's a question, I think, of which countries are going to play Test cricket. You know, whether Sri Lanka can afford to go to West Indies for a two test series that, you know, not much prospect either of making the World Test Championship final. You know, that sort of test series might be just clinging on by the fingernails. But I think, you know, there'll always be in the foreseeable future, England, Australia, India, whatever, the bigger games, and we want to watch New Zealand, don't we? We want three tests in New Zealand. The South Africa, they're reviving. I mean, they're going to be fascinating next summer. You know, let's have three tests against them. Why not make it five? You know, why not let's go back there and tour? So, at the top of the pyramid, there's so much test cricket to be watched, worth watching. But let's not have two test series, please, if possible.
Back onto your book. What is it about?
What is it about? I sensed my time was coming, or my time for touring was coming to an end, because it is now, not when I started, quite a demanding pastime. I mean, the days are long abroad. You know, if it's just a test match day, it's 10 hours for a start. And then next morning, the day after a test, it always seems to be the team have got a flight somewhere at 10:30 in the morning. So whatever time you book for your flight, you know, mid-afternoon, there's always a press conference. The England coaches give you a press conference at 8:30 before they go off to the airport. So, you know, you're finished at, you know, wound down at midnight the night before, then you've got to pack and get into the car, team hotel, whatever. So it can become a very long week after a five-day test. I thought the physical demands were becoming too much. I just wanted to stand back and spend a bit of time at home. the physical demands of Test cricket were coming a bit too much. And so when I went to a country, I sort of realised it was for the last time. And so I would write down notes, flesh out a chapter to, you know, for part of my own sake, just have something to remember, the key moments in each of those countries. Try to capture the essence of each country and each country's cricket. So that's what I wanted to communicate to the reader. So I probably started, 4 or 5 years ago as I toured a country for the last time. And with COVID, people can't go on tour anymore. Hopefully that's changing in the West Indies in the next few weeks. So a lot of people out there may never have been able to go to Australia and know what an Ashes tour is like. And I wanted to capture that experience for them.
Hmm. Would you say the book is primarily a cricket book or a travel book?
Both. It's a cricket travel book. That's what I tried to, yeah. I mean, I've always been interested in travel writing and reading about countries which I've never been to and never will be able to go to. So, sort of passing it on. What's it like to go on an England tour of these countries?
I found your chapter on South Africa fascinating. It ends quite optimistically, but it details some pretty grim stuff that's actually in its recent past, the treatment of players like Ntini and Tsitsobe in the last 15, 20 years. Where did those kernels of optimism at the end of that chapter come for you?
I did the England tour of South Africa, the Test tour, the four Test series tour. And I just thought the sort of spark might have been beginning then. But then the subsequent changes, I think they had sort of truth and reconciliation camps in which people talked. And after that England tour of South Africa, when they went to Pakistan, when they were playing in this T20 World Cup, from a distance on the TV, detected a different body language. Until a couple of years ago, all the white, the national anthems lined up, all the white guys put arms around each other and all the non-white guys put arms around each other on the other side. But I think, Themba Bavuma in the T20 World Cup, there's been a coming together. There is now a colour blindness. They're all celebrating each other's successes equally. They are pulling in the right direction. The strategy, the ideology is now finally sorted out. It's taken, 30 years, but I think they're getting there in the end.
To finish off, just a quick question. If there's one country you could pick out to spend 3 months in for another tour, which would it be?
Pass. I'd probably go for the country which is nearest, simply because I've got a dodgy knee and squeezing into an aircraft seat. But it is like counties. I've got a soft spot for every county, which sounds mushy. I've got a soft spot for each country. I mean, if you've been to a place and you can begin to understand it and its people, you've got a sympathy in build. So it's very difficult to I can't say which, but sorry, yes, it's difficult. There's something to be said for all of them. Soft spot, happy memories in each place, of the place and its cricket. And I wish them all well. Sorry, it sounds a trite thing, but that, I think that's 45 years of traveling around has given me the privilege of being able to get under the skin, to understand separate countries, different places, and that's what's left.
No, that's a good answer, and I think it's one that sells your book well as well. Thanks for your time, Shield. Listeners, if you'd like to buy the book, head to wisden.com/shop and then head to the book section where you'll find Beyond the Boundaries. Thanks again for your time. Phil, go to you for this question. The Ron Out blog asks, In chapter one in this Nagel book, how does he characterise the kind of realism he wants to defend, and how does it differ from other forms of realism? Would be a huge help if you could get this to me in time for my lecture. That's from the Run Out blog.
Well, I think his lecture's already taken place, right? And there's only one person in here with a diploma, so... I don't know. You make your own reality.
So. They've really gone up a notch, haven't they? Yeah. The questions we're getting in.
And then finally, James writes in to say, so James asked a question a couple of weeks ago. If it makes you feel better about the geekery of the pod, I listened to the pod whilst cleaning my golf clubs. On hearing my question, I charged into the sitting room to tell my wife I was now famous and did a dance that definitely lasted longer than it should have done. I was also cleaning my golf clubs in an apron and pink marigolds, so the look was quite something. Keep up the great work and decide to subscribe to the magazine as well now. I don't embarrass easily, so no issues at all if any of the above is read. Fantastic.
Just let that stand for itself. It's the marigolds that completes
yeah.
it, isn't it?
Yeah, nice image. Anyway, that is all for today's show. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Joe. And Carlos, pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for coming, mate. That was great.
Yeah, cheers, Carlos.
Enjoyed
this
it.
Has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. We'll be back next week. Cheers.
Podcast Network.